So Jesus had gathered up five disciples. What were their names? What were the first two? Andrew and the guy that wrote the book, John. Andrew went and found his brother Peter. Then Jesus found Philip, and Philip went and found Nathanael. Thank you. Now I can see. So Jesus has had five disciples for about 2 days, and he shows up at a wedding in Cana on the third day. Last time we were together, I simply talked about Jesus. If there ever was a VIP on planet Earth, it was Jesus, right? He had 3.5 years to do lifetimes worth of work. I mean, think about knowing you're the Messiah and not being allowed to start work till you're 30. And knowing it's going to last 3.5 years. You have 3.5 years to change the world. I've been at this church almost 12 years. All right? I haven't changed the world yet. What did Jesus do? A very important person. Now, you'd think if all you had was 3.5 years, you know, Obama's got 4 to try to change the world, so to speak. At least he wants to. I'm a little skeptical, but that's what he wants to do. And, you know, we see a president. What can he accomplish in 4 years? Well, Jesus had slightly less than that. So you think you'd get Obama out to your wedding or any president? You're not an important enough person. He's got big business to do, see? And here Jesus, who has 3.5 years to get a job done, and he's already gone through 3 months of it, or approximately that, and now he's off up to Cana, some podunk town, the city of reeds, it means, 7 or 8 miles north of his native town of Nazareth. And he spends several days. Weddings lasted days then. You know, I know people now, I got a wedding, you know, got to go to this afternoon. So they pop into a wedding for an hour, maybe go to a reception for a couple more. They go for days. Jesus takes several days and he hangs out. And you find that Jesus' way of changing the world was what? He hung out with people. He didn't start an institution. We labored the church down with an institution, right? Not sure if that's good or bad at times. He didn't start some big institution, didn't start a college, seminary. He just hung out with people. Here, there, the hillside, town, Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, wherever. He hung out with people. He hung out with God. That's what he did. And so the first thing he does in his great ministry, after spending some time in the wilderness, is he hangs out at a wedding. And I suggest that we would probably do a lot more good for God if we do a lot more hanging out with people instead of so much stuff. I don't know what we do, but we're so busy as Christians. We have so many things to do. I was soundly rebuked by myself a week ago. One of my elders and I were talking about someone who used to attend this church that used to be very involved, and they haven't been around for much for the last 2 years. And I said, well, why don't you call him up? So he did. And you know what their question was? How come nobody's called? And then they said, how come the pastor hasn't called? Right? I was too busy with the church for the people. Doesn't that happen to us all the time? Somebody slips out the side door and we're too busy with all the programs and stuff to really hang out with the people. I have to say, it's what I love about all the Hispanics coming into this church. We Anglos, we retreat to our little, you know, through the drawbridge of our garage doors and into our houses. And this church has been coming alive with, we have to say we're closing the gym at midnight because they want to play volleyball till 1 or 2. And finally, even the leaders who are the Hispanics were saying, we got to close this thing down. We need to go to bed. And the social side of this church, the hanging out together side of this church, has just mushroomed in the last 2 years. And it's not because of us white folks. It's because of the Hispanics. I go over there to play volleyball. I'm the only guy keeping score in English. But we're having a good time. I never know what the score is, in fact, because it's all in some other language. But anyway, the language of heaven, right? Anyway, the point I'm just trying to review on here is Jesus was into people, not institutions, not programs. He didn't write any manuals. He hung out with people. He built up people and let people build up people. And that's what the church was supposed to be. And I get so amazed now when I look at various traditions that go back into Christian history. And all of the rigmarole and paraphernalia and liturgy and repeat after me and chanting away that somehow has become Christianity. When in reality, if you look at the Christianity of Jesus, it was worshiping God very simply, not pomp and circumstance, and hanging out with people. That was it. Caring for people, worshiping God. I wonder what's happened. How in the world do we take the model of Jesus and have turned it into the church we have today? It's quite amazing, actually. All right, let's move on with the wedding. Verse 3, they ran out of wine. The mother of Jesus said to him, to Jesus, they have no wine. What does that tell you? Was she responsible? No, she wasn't responsible for them being out of wine. She didn't say we are out of wine. She says they're out of wine. But you get the feeling this is 8 miles from Nazareth. Jesus is there invited. He's invited to bring his new disciples along. Jesus' mother is there. It appears Jesus' brothers were there. This is probably somebody from Cana married someone from Nazareth, and they were all family and friends. And so his mother is not responsible for them running out of wine. It's them, not me. And yet she's concerned. And she goes to Jesus, her son. Now my mother would do that. Right? Any other sons, your mother would do that? There's a problem. Fix it. Please. And it's nice to know our moms believe in us. But sometimes it's not our problem. Right? So Jesus said to her, woman, what does your concern have to do with me? Now that is a really, really difficult phrase to translate. First of all, it's not cold and hard like it sounds. But he says woman, which was a gentle way to speak to his mother in the language. Literally, what to you and to me? What's that? Madam, yes. What to you and to me? And the translators struggle with that. I tell you what I think Jesus was saying. Mom, how is this either your problem or mine? See? Why are you bearing it? Sometimes us sons have to say that to our mothers. This is not even your problem, and it's not... Mom, what does this have to do with you and me? That seems to be what he's saying. So her mother turns to the servants and says, whatever he says to do, do it. That's interesting. Did she take no for an answer? No. Did she push Jesus further? No. She just said to the servants, stay on duty, stay alert, listen, hang close, and if he gives you any directions, do it. So she must have had some level of authority at this wedding because she was able to instruct the servants. Somehow she's involved in the mix of this thing. What does she think Jesus is going to do? And we say, well, work a miracle. Had he ever worked a miracle yet? According to the Gospels, no, because it says at the close of this one, this was the first beginning of signs that Jesus did. So what did Mary think her son was going to do about them being out of wine? He didn't have money. He was a carpenter, not a vintner. They didn't have a wine cellar back home. He could jog home 8 miles and get some bottles. What's he going to do? What is in Mary's brain here? What does she know about Jesus? Is this just a mother-son thing? Or is there something more there? I mean, 30 years before, an angel, or 31 years about now, an angel had come around and said, by the way, you're going to be pregnant. And she said, there's a problem. Can you explain this birds and bees problem that we're going to have here? And the angel says, don't worry about it. God will take care of it. And sure enough, she becomes pregnant. She knows Jesus was not Joseph's son. But that's 30 years ago. She remembers probably when he was at the temple, hanging out with the scribes and Pharisees at age 12, and he'd said when they finally found him 3 days later, don't you know I have to be about my father's business? But beyond that, it says he went home, he was subject to them, he worked in the carpenter shop. What had Jesus ever done? Maybe she'd heard the story of the baptism. This is my beloved son. God spoke from heaven. His dove comes down. I don't know. But it's kind of puzzling to me. What is Mary thinking here? Jesus has never performed a miracle. He hasn't healed anybody. He hasn't fed 5,000. She doesn't have any track record except just this evidently trust in her son. If he can do anything, he'll do it. And yet, it seems she's expecting something out of the ordinary because there's no natural way Jesus is going to go about solving this problem. So that to me is kind of an enigma. What in the world did Mary expect? Now, what I want to focus on today is verse 4. Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. What's he talking about? It's like God isn't going to want me to do wine for another 30 minutes. My hour has not yet come. Let's trace how that phrase is used a little bit through Scripture, through the teachings of Jesus. In a number of places, Jesus spoke of his hour or his time. And I think he has a very specific meaning there that can teach us a lot about living our lives. Go to chapter 7. A couple years have gone by. Jesus has done a lot of miracles. He's fed the 5,000. He's walked on the water and so on. And it comes around to the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, John 7. Where am I? Jesus has done enough miracles and done enough teaching that the folks down in Judea are already rejecting him and wanting to get rid of him. So it starts out after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. He did not walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. When is the Feast of Tabernacles? This is fall. Now I haven't double checked this recently, but I believe this becomes the fall 6 months, yes, before the crucifixion. So the wedding feast at Cana was just before a Passover in the spring, just before the end of the first 6 months of his ministry. We've now gone another year and a half. So 2.5 years later, John covers time quickly here. 2.5 years later, it's time in the fall for the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus is 6 months from the crucifixion. His brothers therefore said to him, so we know Jesus had brothers, Mary had other children. Whether they're older or younger, we don't know. I was always told they had to be older. And I think this is based on the unfounded idea that somehow after having Jesus, Mary wouldn't have any more common children. You know, kind of this immaculate thing. But it said Joseph had no sexual relationship with her until after Jesus was born, which means what happened after Jesus was born? Yeah, we can figure that out pretty simple. And that usually, you know, my in-laws, when they first got married, my wife's parents, they were told by their doctor that the best birth control method was the rhythm method. And of course, Marilyn was born 11 months after the wedding. So it is a very effective means if you want kids. It's only likely that they would have had children. Now, the fact that Joseph is dead, apparently, by the time of Jesus' crucifixion, because he's never mentioned again. All during Jesus' ministry, you don't have Joseph anywhere. So he must have died during the first 30 years of Jesus' life. It's been suggested he was probably older than Mary, that maybe he'd had children by another marriage or something, and that his wife had died or something. That's clearly a possibility. So some of Jesus' brothers could have been older half-brothers, but it's also equally likely that Mary, being a young woman, had several more children. So these are very likely also younger brothers. But Jesus had brothers, family. There's nothing unholy about having children or doing what brings about children. God invented that. He made it. A committee never would have made that. But God did. And it's holy and good, and there's absolutely no reason why Mary has to be some kind of an immaculate thing in order to be holy. So the brothers of Jesus say to him, now Jesus has been ministering for almost 3 years now, and they say to him, depart and go from here to Galilee, or to Jordan, to Judea. I'll get it right. Let me read it again. Depart from here and go to Judea, that your disciples may see the works you are doing, for no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, so show yourself to the world. What is he saying? If you want to be in the movies, go to Hollywood. Isn't that what they're saying? If you want to be in politics, go to Washington. If you want to be the Messiah, go to Jerusalem. What are you hanging out up here in Galilee for? You're not going to start anything up here. The action isn't up here. It's over there in Jerusalem. I think about that with my own church. You know, we have administrative levels. And if you pastor successfully, they move you up to the conference office. Now you sit in committees. Right? And if you do that good, they move you to the next level, and they move and go up to Washington, D.C. to the general headquarters, you know. And I'm sorry, I think you just reach higher levels of irrelevance, personally. The action is where Jesus had the action. The action is where the people are. Not administering institutions that deal with the people. But the brothers have this mentality. If you want to be the Messiah, if you want to be famous, go to headquarters. Go to Jerusalem. Declare yourself. You're not going to accomplish anything in Galilee, the backwoods, the Ozarks, you know. For even his brothers, verse 5, did not believe in him. They looked at the way Jesus conducted himself, and he says, they said, you know, Mom may have said some interesting things about his birth, but this just isn't getting anywhere. He's not becoming famous. He's not attracting an army. He's not going to throw the Romans out. He's just going around being a nice guy. But Jesus said to them, my time has not yet come. Jesus seems to intersperse these two words. My time has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. My time has not yet come. Your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, for it hates me because I testify that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not yet going up to the feast, for my time has not yet fully come. What's he saying? What's he telling his brothers here? Your time's always ready. What does that mean? You set your own schedule. You decide what you're going to do, and you go do it. But Jesus had said elsewhere, I only do what I see the Father doing. Jesus is very clear. He doesn't set his own time schedule. He didn't have a 3-year plan. If you only had 3.5 years to be the Messiah, you'd need a 3.5 year plan according to all the good strategists, right? You need to know what your goals are. And I think there's something to that. But it appears that Jesus simply checked in daily for instructions and followed his Father. He just did what he let God have the 5 year plan. I remember once I was pastoring near San Francisco, lived out in the hills of Marin County. My house was about 3 houses or 5 houses from the end of the road, and there was open space for 20 miles all the way to the ocean through the hills. And I used to walk the trail out there. I remember one day, I was so frustrated, I don't remember why. I think I'd been to a meeting or read a book or done something that, you know, you're supposed to have a plan. Supposed to have a plan. Got to have a 5 year plan. Where do you want to be in 5 years? Where do you want to be in 10 years? And I remember, I've always been frustrated with that because I'm more just a happy wanderer. You know, I just want to enjoy each day and see what comes, you know, which isn't always productive either. But I remember walking out that trail so frustrated, talking to God. I don't have a clue where you want me to be in 5 years, you know. I'm trying to figure out what to preach next Sabbath. And I know I have friends, they have their sermons planned out 2-3 years in advance. How in the world do I know what God needs you to hear in 2 years? You know, I'm not quite sure what he wants you to hear next weekend. You know, we'll talk about it between now and then, and it's kind of an ongoing journey together. Rather than some planned out event, I know where we need to go and I'll take you there. No, I don't know where we need to go. I'm just the lead follower. It's the pastor of the church, right? I'm the lead follower. I say, come on, let's follow Jesus. Come on, there he is. Okay, we got to keep going. I was walking out that trail really frustrated because it's like, I don't have a plan. And it's as if I don't remember quite how God doesn't speak audibly to me, but it's if I heard God say quietly, you don't need a plan. I got a plan. All you need to do is check in daily for instructions. We'll keep you on target. And it just took a big load off my shoulders. I don't have to have a 5 year plan. I need to have a daily walk with Jesus. That's really all you need, right? It's really all you need is a daily walk with Jesus. But Jesus says to the brothers, your time's always there. You make up your own schedule, but my time is not yet fully come. And it seems to mean two things. I don't set my own schedule, and I'm not budging till the Father gives me directions. And secondly, there's a bigger picture. Because they did want to kill him in Judea. And he knew it wasn't time to die yet. He withdrew one other time, just a week before his crucifixion, because they were so intent on killing him, he got out of town. He finally came back for the raising of Lazarus. But Jesus at times stayed away from Jerusalem because it wasn't time to die yet. It wasn't time for the ultimate moment of his life. Everything in his life worked up to that ultimate moment, that moment of sacrifice. So he said, you go on up, but it's not my time. Now the word time here, my time has not yet come, is not the word chronos. What's chronos? A chronographer? Chronological time? It's the word kairos. There are two words for time in the Greek. One is chronos, chronological time. The other is kairos. Kairos seems to be opportunity time. Opportunity time. The moment. Sometimes there's a moment. You know, you hang around somebody and you want to ask something and you're kind of waiting till the right moment. You're not thinking chronologically. You're thinking kairos. You're thinking opportunity. That's the kind of time Jesus is talking about here. The opportunity time in my life has not yet come. Now, what's interesting, he said, you go up to the feast, verse 8, I'm not going up yet, for my time has not yet fully come. And he remained in Galilee. But when the brothers had gone up, he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. So he did go. But he didn't go with the crowds. Going from Galilee down to the feast of Jerusalem would be a big deal. Tens of thousands of people would take the trip. And they would travel in caravans, bunches, along the road. And they always took the long route because they didn't want to have to talk to a Samaritan. So they would head south from the Sea of Galilee and east across the Jordan, walk an extra 20 or 30 miles on the trip just to avoid Samaria. And then they'd head down the east side of the Jordan to Jericho and come up the mountain from Jericho, up the gorge. And so this crowd of people would go. Jesus waited till the feast had already begun. His brothers had gone. The crowd had gone. There's a lot of buzz about this Jesus person, you know. What's he doing? Who is he? The next part of the chapter tells us they were all talking about it in Jerusalem. He goes up after everybody's gone, just quietly, and he just shows up. Verse 11 and 12, the Jews sought him at the feast, said, "Where is he?" There was murmuring. You know, some said he's good, some said he's evil. So he was the buzz. And yet he just kind of walks into town without a crowd, a little late, but in no time flat, he's in trouble. He's drawn in. People are talking. He went and taught in the temple, verse 28, chapter 7. He cried out as he taught in the temple, saying, "You both know me and you know where I come from. And I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. But I know him, for I am from him, and he sent me." Then they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. They even tried to take him to kill him at that feast. He went up when God said, go. That seems to be the picture. I'm not going till I get instructions. After everybody was gone, God said, now go up quietly. So he went up. He starts teaching in the temple. There's a big argument about who he is. They send people out to take him, but they didn't. Because it wasn't his time yet. God protected him. They wanted to take him, but they couldn't touch him. His time had not yet come. Chapter 8. The story continues. We get down to verse 20 of chapter 8. This is where they have that whole discussion of who's your daddy. Accuse him of being an illegitimate child. They said to him, verse 19, "Where's your father?" Jesus said, "You know neither me nor my father. If you had known him, you had known my father also." These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him, for his hour had not yet come. Chapter 12, after the triumphal entry. This is now just the week that ended in his crucifixion. Chapter 12, verse 23. We'll start in 20. "Now there were certain Greeks among those who came to worship at the feast. They came to Philip, who is from Bethsaida of Galilee, and asked him, saying, 'Sir, we wish to see Jesus.' Philip told Andrew, and Philip told Jesus, and Jesus said, 'The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified.'" At the end of the triumphal entry, he changes his tune. He knows he's in his last week. And now he says, "It's time, guys. It's time." Verse 27. "For my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. For this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Chapter 13, they're in the upper room. Verse 1, before the feast of Passover, this is the night on which he was betrayed, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from the world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end, or he loved them to the utmost. Chapter 16, verse 19. Jesus is talking to his disciples there in the upper room and on out towards the garden. He has not yet been betrayed. It's interesting, you know, in 4 or 5 chapters, John covers 2.5 years. But in chapter 13 to chapter 17, he covers about 2.5 hours. Okay? It really slows down here. Chapter 16, verse 19. Now Jesus knew that they desired to ask him, and he said to them, "Are you inquiring among yourselves about what I said? A little while and you will see me, and a little while and you will not see me, and again a little while and you will see me. Most assuredly I say to you that you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. A woman, when she is in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come. But as soon as she has given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish, for the joy of a human being has been born in the world. Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy no one will take from you." Notice Jesus likens his hour to giving birth. This is the moment of anguish, but it's going to birth a great joy. That's what all of our mothers thought, right? When we were born, we were a joy. What happened? I've been told birth is no fun. You can all testify to that. I haven't gone through it. Verse 32. "Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered each to his own and leave me alone. Yet I'm not alone. The Father is with me." Chapter 17, verse 1. Jesus spoke these words, lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may be glorified in you. As you have given him authority over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as you have given him. And this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom he has sent. I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work that you have given me to do. Now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world began." So notice Jesus says, "Time's up. I'm done. Now, God, let the closing scene, let the birthing process here, this point of anguish, let it be to your glory." Jesus lived for this time. In the other Gospels, Matthew, when Jesus sends his disciples out to find a place to do the Passover, they're supposed to tell the master of the house, our master says, his hour has come. The disciples are sleeping. Jesus wakes them up and says, the hour is at hand. Wake up, the hour is at hand. Jesus' time, Jesus' hour was set by the Father's clock, and everything he did was focused with a momentum towards the culminating sacrifice of Calvary. I believe that everything Jesus did was focused on the greater human issue of salvation. I don't believe Jesus provided wine at the wedding primarily because they needed wine. He did it for a bigger reason. He healed the sick. He raised the dead. He did everything for a bigger reason. If you think about it, providing wine for a party or healing a blind man in light of eternity is a rather insignificant thing, unless it plays a part in a much bigger drama, a higher agenda for his compassion than temporarily fixing a problem. I think this is, when we look at this, we can understand a little bit why doesn't Jesus heal more people now or then, or why didn't he heal me or you? God has a bigger agenda than you and me. He has an agenda of getting sin out of the universe. He has an agenda of saving lots of people. And sometimes fixing my little problem is not necessarily what's going to help the bigger agenda. So he lets my problem stay and says, trust me. But I believe every time Jesus did a miracle, he had the bigger perspective. His Father was setting the clock. His Father was calling the shots. Jesus' compassion was for the whole human race to save them all. He couldn't be distracted by lesser acts of compassion, so to speak. Only the Father had the true perspective to look down at Jesus and say, okay, heal that one. All right, now go over, do that one. I think God directed things. It was all on God's timing. And I think we need to do the same thing. in ministry. Just because there's a need doesn't mean you're the one that's supposed to fix it. Like Mary, they're out of wine. Mom, how do you know this is something you're supposed to deal with? There's a lot of good things out there that need to be done, and we need to ask God, which of the good things that need to be done do you have on the agenda for me? Remember, you're not the only person serving the Lord. Now, I'm not saying we should make this an excuse for walking away from people and letting them suffer. Okay? Let's not become uncompassionate over that. But on the other hand, you've only got so much time. And so we need to be saying to God, how do you want me to use my time for others? Not just go out and do whatever you see. Sometimes you may have to say, I'm sorry, that my hour hasn't come. God hasn't put that on my agenda, but God will take care. I like the words of Oswald Chambers. He's talking about the fact that at times God will allow things to happen in somebody's life for discipline and growth. And that it's probably not God's will for you to jump in and fix the problem while God's still trying to deal with that person's character. And he says this phrase. Well, it's kind of like never help a chick break out of its shell. It'll die. Oswald Chambers says, no saint dare interfere in the discipline of suffering in another saint. Sometimes we need to say, God, do you want that relieved? Or do you want that left alone? God does have an agenda, and we need to know His. A discipline aborted now will have to be redone later. So Jesus says, my hour has not yet come. His life was focused on one thing, the ultimate reason that God had brought him into this world. And I believe our lives need to be focused on one thing. We need to ask God, what is the ultimate reason He's brought us into this world? Every life has a purpose. You are a unique person. There'll never be anyone else like you in the universe, in eternity. And the Bible says that God saw you before you were born. And from the foundation of the world, He made a plan for your life. And we need to be going to God and saying, God, what's my life for? What's the purpose of my life? Would you then guide me through the maze of distractions so that I can actually stay on course? Your course for me. Not some other Christian's course for me, what they tell me. You know, I smile at the fact that 12 years ago, and it is just about 12 years ago, January, February, March, I went in to see my conference president in Northern California where I was pastoring. And I told him I was moving to Phoenix. And he told me all the reasons why I should not come here to pastor. And they all made sense. They all made sense. I didn't have the experience for a church this size. I'd only pastored one other church, and it never was bigger than 50. You know, and here we're the largest Adventist church, or next to largest, depending. Right there are two of us here in Arizona. Like, an associate pastor? I'd never had a staff. And here this seasoned administrator told me all the reasons why I shouldn't come. And all I could do was say, you're absolutely right. But God won't let me not go. Because I didn't want to come. I didn't want to leave just north of San Francisco to come to the desert. I like the ocean. But God's made it clear to both Marilyn and me, we're supposed to do this. And sometimes all the good sense that well-meaning Christians who care about you can tell you is going to be overruled by the sense of conviction that God puts in your heart that this is where you're supposed to go. And I don't believe just pastors are the ones for whom God has an overall purpose in life. I believe every last person, God has an overall reason for your life. You may not preach sermons, but you are a sermon. He's got a reason. He's got a mission. And I think one of the greatest things that you need to do as you spend time with God is say, God, what's the mission? I only need to know one day at a time, but I'd love to have a sense of where we're headed. Share with me what you can about the bigger purpose. I'd like to keep the daily stuff in line with the bigger purpose. I'll trust you one day at a time, but why am I here? None of us are here just to get enough to eat without being eaten. None of us are here just to make money or build widgets or do whatever we do. There's a bigger reason. And I think as we look at Jesus here, he said, my hour has not yet come. I only do what the Father shows me. You're only going to find that out if you spend significant hours with the Father. Right? So the key to knowing the purpose of your life is very simple. Hang out with Jesus. Alone, quiet, for hours. Take some time. This last week's been busy. I've been so busy getting sermons ready for evangelistic meetings, I've had very little time to hang out with God. And I woke up this morning and I just felt like totally out of gas. I'm supposed to preach three times today and I don't have anything to say to anybody. You know? And I had to get alone this morning and say, God, people are expecting, you know, my delinquency can't wreck the whole day for everybody else. Would you please come through? Next week, I need to make a focus of hanging out more with Jesus. Alone, me, you, with Jesus. That's where the power, that's where the direction, that's where the stability comes from. Wouldn't it be cool to have such a clear understanding of God's will for your life that someone wants you to go do something and you say, no, that's not on God's agenda for me. I don't mean be hoity-toity and high and mighty about it, but just wouldn't it be nice to be that clear to say, no, I know that's not what God wants me to do. He wants me to head this direction. And walk through our lives with a sense of confidence and purpose because we trust God and His agenda. And we're living on God's time, the title for my sermon. Living on God's hour, God's time. A challenge. And there's nothing more exciting in life than living on God's time. He'll get you in more pickles and predicaments and get you out in the most amazing ways, and you'll actually see people find Jesus.